Municipal Hess Committee to order at this time. All members are present. Senator Dyson, Cowdery, Thomas, and Elton, and Betty Davis, Chair. We have three bills coming before us today. We're going to take up SJR 29, and then we will take lost my place on the number. 284, that's right. 284. We do have present Senator Hocker and staff. If you want to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You're quite welcome. You may give your testimony.
Madam Chairman, again, thank you very kindly for the opportunity to be before your committee today. House Joint Resolution 29 is one of the recommendations that came out of this summer's Joint Legislative Education Task Force, which it was my distinct pleasure to chair along with members of the Senate and the House. The House Joint Resolution 29 was included in the task force recommendations at the request of Senator Ellis. And he had identified and been very concerned with the issue of the federal government living up to its commitment to fund the education for children with disabilities. Where the United States or the Congress had passed what was called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, it had authorized, and of course, like ourselves, subject to future funding, that the federal government would appropriate a sum equal to 40% of the average per pupil expenditure for education of students under that act. The evidence brought forward by the Department of Education is that this spending has been more on the order of about 16%, I think. I'm not sure I've got my right number, but yes, the federal government's been funding about 16% instead of the 40% that their act said they should be funding. And this resolution is simply a statement of the position of the Alaska legislature expressing our great desire that the federal government would fund to the 40% rather than the 16% level, ma'am.
Yes. Any questions? Our members? Yes, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, anyhow, at least. I realize that we're going from 16 to 40 here, anyhow. That's the request. But I find the wording odd, you know, that free appropriate public education for students with disabilities, and that amounts to 40%. But I guess that is what it is. But to use the terminology free, and then it says 40%, it's not a, I guess that's just, this is in conjunction with federal legislation, and that is how the federal legislation reads, is that that it's going to 40%? Is there existing legislation to that effect currently?
Senator Thomas, yes, it's my understanding, and in the interest of full disclosure to your committee, the exact language in this bill was proposed by Senator Ellis's office. However, we've reviewed it, worked with them, and yes, we conformed the language here to the language of the federal statute.
Okay.
I'd like to just say the federal statutes, when they passed that, the federal government agreed to give 40% towards the funding of special ed needs. They have not. The highest we've gotten is 16%, and that's why he's asking for them to step up to the plate and be obligated to do what they chose to do, but yet haven't given us the funds. Any other questions? If you don't have any other questions, is there anybody in the online that want to testify to this bill? I don't have anything in front of me. Is there anybody in the audience? Apparently not. This resolution is a very important piece of legislation, and I would like to see that it keep moving forward so we can get it to D.C. What is the wish of the body with this piece of legislation? I'd be willing to move it out if you're feeling comfortable with that.
Madam Chairman, I move that H.J.R. 29 be moved committee, moved from committee. There are with individual recommendations, as there are no fiscal notes, I guess.
Right. 1-0.
There is.
0 fiscal note.
Oh, 0 fiscal note. Is that what you're saying? Okay. All right. Okay.
Any objection? Here, no objection. We don't have to call the roll, and we will move 29 out of Hess committee. Is there any further referrals on that? I don't see on this page that it is.
No, ma'am. I believe there are.
Okay. So we'll go to rules next.
No, that's it.
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. You have one other bill, and we'll go to 284.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 284 resulted from constituent contacts that I had in my district and from constituent contacts that Representative Beth Gratula had from some of her constituents. So not that that would be an attempt to influence Senator Elton. The permanent fund dividend is something that has truly become almost sacred to Alaskans. And while the original intent of the permanent fund dividend language back those many years ago was that it would be for only resident Alaskans, you know, very quickly the questions arose and said, well, that is unfair to certain Alaskans, and specifically, it would be unfair to students who had embarked upon a course of university education and were pursuing education that, quite frankly, might not even be available in Alaska. So, of course, the legislature passed what we kind of refer to as the exception to the absence statutes, saying that a person may be absent from Alaska for specific purposes and still receive your permanent fund dividend. The very first exception that was created is if you are absent receiving secondary or post-secondary education on a full-time basis. Clearly, I don't think I've ever met anyone that didn't feel that was an appropriate exception from the or an inclusion in the allowable absence statutes. And what came to our attention is that I think that through the process of writing regulations, interpreting that statute, we have a miscarried justice and created an inequitable situation that we can remedy fairly readily here. While the exception says you're outside receiving secondary, post-secondary education on a full-time basis, we have run into a situation where the regulators have determined and interpreted that to mean that we do not allow students who are traveling abroad on the prestigious Fulbright scholarship. And just a very quick comment on the Fulbright scholarship. The Fulbright program was created in 1946 in the aftermath of World War II, specifically to foster better understanding among peoples of nations, again, in that the aftermath of that truly world tragedy, to try to prevent future such reoccurrences. The program operates in a way where a student who is awarded a Fulbright scholarship is allowed to go sit in a reserved seat, so to speak, sort of like a fellowship at a foreign university, study, fully participate, continuing their education. But the problem got into the regulations, because the regulations have been written that says if you're going to qualify for an out-of-state educational exception, you have to be enrolled as a student. You have to be enrolled. Well, Fulbright scholars, because they are allowed to go occupy a reserved seat, do not have to go through a formal enrollment process at that foreign university. They occupy a reserved seat. So literally, you have a very talented, bright young Alaskans, graduate students, attending their graduate school. They're continuing to receive their permanent fund dividend. They accept the honor, the distinction of a Fulbright award, spend a semester or a year. You know, these things can run from upwards of, it's a little bit of varying lengths, but a semester or a year studying as part of at a foreign university, and they're denied their permanent fund dividend for the period in which they're there on a Fulbright. Now, then they come back to the university where they are a student, enroll for the next semester, and they start receiving their dividend again. And respectfully, I just think that's inequitable. That's certainly not what I believe was the intent of the legislature. Now, we did, madam, and I think it was very important in that we did work with the Department of Revenue Permanent Fund Division to attempt to remedy this by amending the regulations. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Richter, who is with us here today, worked with us on this. But I think, quite frankly, we were both frustrated just in dealing with sort of that legal quagmire of the regulation writers who felt that, for whatever reason, they did not want to change their regulations, that they felt it might expose, I guess, the interpretation of law to something they didn't want to accomplish. And I believe we could have fixed this in regulation. The regulators have said we can't, so we're back here fixing it in statute. And that is what all this is, ma'am, is a simple bill that adds the language that a person has an allowable absence if they are participating for educational purposes in a student fellowship sponsored by the United States Department of Education or the United States Department of State. And that is the sort of broad language, and that someday we might not call it the Fulbright program. They might change it to the Senator Betty Davis International Scholarship Program. But if we just simply say that it is sanctioned by the Department of Education, the United States Department of State, is the general phrase for that, including that sort of program, ma'am.
Thank you. Are there any questions from this? Yes, Senator Cowdery?
Yes. The military that are out of state, whether in Iraq or anyplace else, they're exempt. They can still, if they're residents of Alaska, still get the dividend?
They still get it.
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, absolutely, sir. In that the only qualification is that they must have an intent to return to the state of Alaska.
And I was wondering, what about, well, I know we've had a bill for the Peace Corps people here that has never went any place, but what does the permanent fund people say? Are they here to testify today?
Madam Chair, Senator Cowdery. Yes, we do have representatives from the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, mm-hmm. but I would note that a year ago, the language that expanded the except allowable absences to Peace Corps volunteers was included in statute now, and it is now the 14th exception from the residency requirements.
Thank you.
Yes, any other question?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Elton?
Just a comment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I admire the way you put this, and I'm going to incorporate into my testimony on the House side, some suggestion that the committee chair may have something named after them also. I think it's very effective, and I know it got my attention, and I wouldn't mind seeing it named the Betty Davis Scholarship Fund. Madam Chair, would it be appropriate at this time, while the sponsor is still at the table, for me to offer an amendment?
I was going to let people testify and then bring that forward. Could you wait that long?
Madam, you have me all afternoon.
All right, thank you. Representative Hawk.
Madam.
Yes.
Chair.
You have the floor.
Well, I just think that Senator Elton's point might bear consideration. At least I would encourage you to let him announce what his amendment does so that the people come up and testify, if they had a comment on that, could do so as well.
Okay, that's a good idea. I haven't any problem with that. Do you have a copy?
Madam Chair.
Is it at everybody's place?
It is, but Madam Chair, I am conflicted. I mean, can I say what the amendment is and then offer it later? I've been waived to testify on one of my bills right next door. So if I could announce and then move the amendment after the testimony, that would work better for me.
Yeah, I don't plan to take the vote, no.
Okay. Madam Chair, to Senator Dyson's point, this amendment would expand to VISTA volunteers the same exception under the law as has been extended to the Peace Corps, as has been extended to people who work in the Marine, in the maritime industry, and others. And so if that is enough so that people can comment to that point, I'll disappear for 5 minutes and then be back.
All right. Everybody have a copy of the amendment? And do you have it, Representative Hawker?
I believe I do, ma'am.
Okay.
Probably not the amendment for this commission.
The amendment.
The same amendment. Thank you, ma'am.
There is someone in the audience to testify. Would you come forward, please, and give your name for the record?
Madam Chairwoman and committee members, my name is Demian Shane. I live at 836 Calhoun Avenue in Juneau, and I have written testimony in the record. I just wanted to put a face behind it. Last year, I went to Iceland on a Fulbright exchange. I designed a program that I felt was connected both interests in Iceland and Alaska. I studied the policies and regulations behind preventing escapes of farmed fish from fishing operations, which I know is an important question here as it proposals fly back and forth each year. So I was curious as to how they were doing it over there and what some of the policies were. And so I went over there and worked with a couple professors and studied that and came back here and I'm now present.
Very good experience for you?
It was a fantastic experience. Thank
wonderful,
you.
Wonderful. Any questions? Yes, Senator Dyson.
So I take it you're in favor of this bill?
Yes. I have no position or opinion on Senator Elton's proposed amendment, but I appreciate the efforts that Hawker and Ms. Debbie Richter have put into getting this done.
Thank you.
We thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
This is the cheapest consulting contract we ever had.
Yes. There was somebody, your question, you got your question answered though, didn't you? So we don't need anybody from the permit fund to come forward?
I guess I would like somebody from.
Would you please come and state your name for the record? And your affiliation would be good for you to
Hello.
Tell us. Yes.
Madam Chair, my name is Debbie Richter and I am the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division.
Okay. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thanks for the job you do. At least it appears like you're doing a marvelous job. So I think the Permanent Fund Board has pushed back at the myriad of exceptions that we keep coming up with. And can you kind of summarize or what causes that pushback and what the dangers are as we continue to expand the exceptions?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I can tell you that the more allowable absences that are introduced increases, you know, obviously the eligibility workload of the division. We've been advised by council that to enlarge it to a certain point is okay, but once you go beyond that, then you basically open it up to, you know, everything and any reason, and it becomes difficult for the division to qualify people in eligibility, thus the problem we have here. In regulation, they've defined what is a student, and in order to change that regulation to include the fellowships, the language was just very difficult, and we had trouble with, you know, not opening it up to people who live outside who are taking internet school, you know. I mean, there had to be lines, and I think that that's the only thing to really pay attention to is, can it be defined? If it can be defined very clearly so that we're fair in our eligibility determinations, then I don't, you know, see it as a problem.
If I may follow up a couple
yes,
of questions. So I assume that that what Representative Hawker has put forward here, when they have to be in some official way lined up with the Fulbright organization and that process, that makes the definition reasonably easy.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I believe it does.
Yeah. So, if I may, a college athlete who was really good and had a year of kind of leaving their academic studies and going to a training camp in anticipation of some world competition, that would be problematic.
I believe so.
Under the existing law, because it says education. All right. And if you could ever tell us what the legal guys have said about how we know when we're getting close to that precipice, that would be useful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions?
How many, just if you can get it off the top of your head, our current population in the state versus how many checks do we send out yearly, or the last go around?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, we sent out 632,000 permanent fund dividend checks. Approximately 10,000 of those checks were to people who do not live in the state at this time. They're not physically present in the state. Is that what you were hoping?
Yes, and who is eligible? Are felons eligible?
Felons? No, sir. They are not. If they were incarcerated during the year that they were either sentenced or incarcerated, they are not eligible. After that, then they are.
And is there any checks on citizenship? What citizenship do the recipients are?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, the requirements are that a person have actually filed for citizenship. The rules now are not that they accomplish that goal, but that they are in the process of attempting it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience that want to testify on this bill, or anybody online or off net? Senator, Representative Harker, would you please come back? Somebody else is on?
You have somebody online. We heard from Rob Cullen.
Rob Cullen, are you there? Cullen?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Would you just speak up a little louder? I'll pull the microphone up closer to you.
I'm sorry, the phone here has a poor connection.
Oh, that's good, no.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the committee for considering this bill. My name is Rob Cullen, as has been stated, and I'm from Anchorage. And as a former Fulbright scholar to Italy, I am a strong proponent of this bill. I believe you all already have my written testimony in front of you there, but I would just like to say that I believe this bill is extremely important to Alaska scholars, and happy to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody have a question of Mr. Colley? All right. Anyone else to testify? If not, we'll go back to the sponsor of this bill. And you have that amendment in front of you. I'd like for you to give your opinion of this, and if that's going to be a problem for you, or if you could speak to that amendment. And I guess I can do that without adopting it. I haven't. The senator that introduced this is having another bill being heard. I guess since he gave it to you, if someone want to move that amendment.
I would move amendment number one to, I would move the committee substitute for House Bill 284. Is that where we're?
Amendment.
Amendment number one is the only one we have.
Number one, that's mm-hmm. the only one we have. Mm-hmm. I'll object to that for discussion purpose at this time.
And thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, I have seen this amendment several times along the way. This amendment proposes to add a new exemption, unrelated to the education exemption that's in the bill at the moment, and that would exempt folks who are serving as volunteers under the National Community Service Trust Act of 1993, which has been generically referred to as AmeriCorps. We have the Peace Corps, which is Foreign Service. We have this, the federal government established this AmeriCorps system, which is domestic service. I have really two. I'm thinking I have resisted this along the way, and it's been for two reasons. The first reason is that it's very pragmatic, and it is not in any way expressing any opinion or comment on the value and importance of the AmeriCorps program. And that is, as I think Senator Dyson had brought forward the issue of this, it's always very I guess right. There's a lot of controversy about every single amendment or exception we add to the permanent fund residency statutes. And there are a number of legislators, and I, you know, frankly, include myself in that, that tend to resist expanding this reasons you can be out of the state. The permanent fund dividend was really meant for in-state residents. That creates such a conflict and such, controversy within the legislature that controversy truly does not exist. I've not found it to exist anywhere when we're talking about making sure that the existing education exception includes someone on the Fulbright Scholar Program. I think, as we've seen by folks talking about it, and I'm be happy to answer further any questions, but I really believe that was a place where the regulations got sideways with the intent of an existing statute. Adding the AmeriCorps program, in addition to this, simply creating philosophic problems among individual legislators, where it could frankly make it difficult to correct the inequity that we're really addressing with this bill. As I think there may be enough opposition amongst members in both bodies that wouldn't like, that frankly would oppose the whole bill as a result of including a new program without discussing that in its on its own merits. But I would also, then my second point, in addition to really what I call the pragmatic opposition to sort of, to use the vernacular, Christmas treeing the bill, is that the VISTA program has been discussed in this body as a possible exception to the residency requirements, and that was in the context of bringing the Peace Corps exception into statute. And we researched the record of testimony on the Peace Corps amendment, and at that time it was also proposed that the VISTA program be considered as a possible exception. And at that time, the body of test, or the consensus, the testimony, led to where the legislature had concluded that, well, the Peace Corps was a foreign service operation, and very clearly you could draw a line there, that was acceptable, but that since VISTA volunteers can serve anywhere in America, in fact, there are VISTA volunteers from other states working in Alaska, that the desire was to encourage people who might be VISTA volunteers that want to go volunteer to volunteer and work in Alaska, for Alaskans to help Alaskans, rather than say, well, if you want to go, help in Kentucky or wherever it might be in America, that we might actually be creating conflicting objectives here. We want young Alaskans to stay and help in Alaska, but we're going to incentivize them to go work in other states through the maintenance of the permanent fund dividend. So certainly it's a policy call for a legislature, but I would, I just respectfully ask the committee to leave this bill as it is, which is truly righting a wrong that's being done to individual Alaskans. I think it's very clearly that wrong exists where regulation has contravened what is very clearly the intent of our earlier statutes, and folks that wish to pursue the VISTA volunteer exception bring it forward as its own proposition to stand on its own merits.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? At this time, I'd like to just set this aside to give Senator Elton a chance to get back in the room. I can go to another bill, or we could just take a brief at ease to see if he's going to be back very shortly.
You might want to go to another bill because they'll have finance back up here.
Okay, we're going to go to another bill. We're going to go to two, which you do have in front of you. And the reason you have this in front of you is because there was an amendment that was put into the bill since we last heard it. And
280.
Overmari, would you come in and go over the bill?
Madam Chair and members of the HES Committee, for the record, I'm Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. Excuse me for just a second.
And we're playing double duty with him because the chair, the aide for this committee is out ill. So Mr. Overmeyer is taking over his duties as well as carrying this bill.
Ron's overworked.
Don is sick. He has bronchitis and the flu.
Before you, you have a new version of this committee substitute for Senate Bill 280. And it's called, we call it the E version. It's 25 LS 1464E, drafted on March the 24th this year, 2008. And the explanation for the changes are that the E version reflects and defines language routinely found in other state statutes concerning clinical trials. These changes make clear the objective of this bill to require insurers to have to cover no more than routine patient care costs, and specifically excludes other extraordinary non-clinical costs of housing, companion costs, and related, et cetera, related to clinical trials. In detail, the E version 1 replaces coverage of the costs of medical care with routine patient care costs as defined on pages on page 2, lines 30 to 31, ending page 3, line 17. Specifically, A, routine patient care costs are medical care costs which are related to cancer that would otherwise be covered under a health care insurance plan if the medical care was not in connection with an approved clinical trial related to cancer, including costs of transportation essential to the medical care. This section also excludes a drug or device associated with the clinical trial not approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, housing, companion expenses, other non-clinical expenses associated with the trial, an item or service provided solely to satisfy data collection and analysis not used in the clinical management of the patient, an item or service excluded from coverage under the patient's health care insurance plan, and an item or service paid for customarily through grants or other funding. Two, it requires the insurer to provide coverage under this section only if, A, there is no clearly no superior non-investigational treatment alternative, and B, available clinical or preclinical data provide a reasonable expectation that the treatment provided in the clinical trial will be at least as efficacious or that is capable of producing the desired effect as any non-investigative or investigational alternative. And I refer you to page 1, line 13, beginning with the healthcare and ending on page 2, line 7. Finally, coverage is subject to the standard policy provisions applicable to other benefits, including deductible or copayment provisions found on page 2, lines 10 through 11. Those are the changes that were made in the bill to comport with the language usually found in other states and within our insurance policies.
I'd also like to add to this that these changes that have been made has also been given to the people that asked that this bill be introduced, and they have no problem with it. And we did meet with the director of insurance, and these are suggestions that she recommended, recommendations that we should add in here. It's a labor and commerce issue, but since we had the bill in our presence when she testified, we decided to go on and have them put in there, particularly since the doctors that want this bill to pass had no problems with it.
Correct.
So when it goes to labor and commerce, that would already be in there. And of course, they might have other issues that they want to address at that time. Did you have your hand up, Senator Dyson? No?
Remember, us old people are slow.
No. I'm not pushing you. I just want to know I didn't recognize you.
I felt I was pushed.
Oh, no. Sorry about that.
So this referrals go here and then to Labor and Commerce and
yeah,
then
it is this bill has to go to Labor and Commerce, yes.
And any other committees?
Finance. It has two more places to go.
That's a place where good bills go to die.
Well, you could be right on that, but
all right.
It has a finance on it.
All right, thank you.
Because there is an issue with that. Yes. Any other comments? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I understand it, this, unless I'm misunderstanding the routine patient care costs, it is specifically addressing care only for that directly related to the clinical procedures and whatever's taking place. It would rule out other diagnoses. If somebody is diagnosed with some other particular disease during the experimental treatment, that would not be covered. Is that what we're saying or attempting to preclude anyhow?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, it's my understanding that it is directed only to the clinical trial. If routine patient care were to include a contemporaneous discovery of other diseases or ailments, that might be included just because they're already being tested under the clinical trial. I don't know. That's a question probably for the medical doctors that I couldn't, or even the insurers. I can't answer that question directly.
And I would also assume that if it was something that, you know, was considered as due to the treatment and the weakening of the immune system or something like that, that somebody might contract some other diseases, that there'd be close enough chain or whatever to determine that would be taken care of by this bill still.
I believe it would, and in the language of the bill itself, I think you'll find that it defines what types of diseases and cancers may be discovered.
It does.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Cowdery?
Yeah. And what other states has this type of language been instituted? Do you know?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, there are over 5,000 to 6,000 cancer trials going on at any one time in the United States. So virtually every state has cancer trials that are going on. And I've carefully examined the statutes of a number of states before we came up with this language.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. I'm trying to catch up here. If we pass this, this is a what-if circumstance, clinical trials that are going on a new kind of treatment, what happens if it's 10 times as expensive as the common and usual treatment? Is the insurance company, because we passed this, committed to having to pay that unexpected cost for that patient?
Senator Dyson, I'd rather than him answer that, because I don't think he can answer that question. We'd have to get further information from you, for you, on that issue. But it would be my understanding that if they're treating one type of cancer and some other medical problem would arise, then that physician would end up getting someone to handle that. Because these are oncologists that's dealing with cancer patients, mainly. So if there's other illness that shows up also, someone else would have to address that.
Yeah.
They usually have two or three doctors. When you go in like that, you might have an oncologist, you might have a regular primary doctor, or it might be some other specialist that would have to come and look at you.
I either spoke my question not succinctly, or there was a problem in communication. I'm talking about for the cancer. What's your answer, Mr. Obermeyer?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, it has been determined that the cancer patient is going to be treated with whatever's necessary currently, and if they have an increasing cancer problem, that is considered routine care every time they go into their oncologist. This clinical trial is a completely separate plan to try to assist in determining new preventative measures and so forth. Those are in fact something that I was not aware of when I began this, is that many patients are already traveling outside to do that, or to other states in order to get their participate in a trial. We have, and nationally, there's really a very small percentage of people that that go into trials. But the costs are supposed to be routine, and routine cost means that if they aren't in the trial, they're going to be getting the same cost anyway, as explained by, as I recall,
Dr. Jeannie Anderson, because they have to have treatment. And so this is nothing out of the ordinary other than the fact that they're encouraging people to participate in trials to encourage them to the point that they are not dissuaded from participating for fear of losing their regular coverage through their routine visits if they were to participate in a trial. And that's one of the reasons that patients are concerned. They want to make sure if they participate in a trial that all at once they're not knocked off their insurance plan.
Yeah. You got at part of the answer I was looking for. If they and their physician choose to participate in one of these clinical trials, and the cost of doing that is 10 times as much as what the alternative would have been if they didn't choose this clinical trial, does the is the insurance company on the hook for paying 10 times as much for the treatment because we passed this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, it was explained in my explanation of the version, and this was already remedied by this version, that it requires the insured to provide coverage only if there's clearly no superior non-investigational treatment alternative, and B, available clinical or preclinical data provide a reasonable expectation that the treatment provided in the clinical trial will be at least as efficacious as the non-investigational alternative. That's essentially what they're driving at. They do not want to drive up cost unreasonably that would be handled otherwise.
And we also had people to testify that have been on clinical trials, and they testified that they had some concern if their insurance company would continue to cover them. And one of the people that testified said that she was approved by her insurance company to keep going with that. You want some additional information, we could get it. I don't know if there's any of the doctors online, but if they are, we could have one of them to speak to it also.
It's not a doctor question. It's a legal question. And
well, if you need a legal opinion, we could also get that. But I thought you were just saying what we knew about the bill, if that will actually be covered. And I know it was spoken to when we took the testimony at the last hearing. But if you need further information, we can ask for that. This bill has two other places to go, and I'm sure we can get an answer to that. Or they'll tell us they're not able to give us an answer. Any other discussion on 280? And just for your own information, Senator Elton, we're on 280, the clinical trial studies.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I had just one quick question.
Yes. Senator Thomas.
Madam Chairman, on Section 1, page 2, line 12, what is paragraph D? This section does not apply to a fraternal benefit society. What is that in reference to?
Through the Chair, Senator Thomas, this was explained, I think, to Senator Cowdery in the last hearing on this bill, and we had at that time the drafter online who explained that this needed to be explained because there's some type of language in other statutes that would require that this be included in this particular bill.
Okay. That's good. That's okay.
And that's what the drafter said when she came and testified last time.
Okay.
Any other questions? And like I said, you do have the changes in front of you. That's all that's been done to the bill. And really, we have discussed the bill, but I never asked anyone to accept the
You need a motion to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 280/E as a working draft.
Any objection to that? We'll just continue our discussion then. Not. I don't have any other input to give you on this piece of legislation. It was my desire, if this is accepted to you, that we will pass this out, knowing that it has two other places to go, that is labor and commerce and finance. We are about to run out of time. I'd like to move this on if we can.
Madam Chair,
yes.
There is someone online who would like to testify.
Emily Neenan? Emily?
Yes, this is Emily Neenan.
Yes, would you testify?
Yes, I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society, and I have not fully reviewed the CS, so I'll withhold the bulk of my comments until it gets to Labor and Commerce if I have any other comments. But to Senator Dyson's questions, I just wanted to mention that in general, the impetus behind this kind of legislation is not to increase any cost to the insurance companies, simply to make sure that people have access to the clinical trials. And that's what the whole piece around routine care costs is referring to. And I can would be happy to get him more information as the bill moves on. But I just wanted to point that out. And also, there was a question about other states. There are 20 other states with this provision in statute, as well as 4 that have worked out voluntary agreements with all the insurance companies in their states.
Thank you. Did you have other testimony?
No, that would be all.
Well, thank you for your help there.
Sure.
Any questions of her? Seeing none? Anybody in the audience to testify? Or anyone else online? This seems to complete it. I'd like to entertain a motion to move this piece of legislation today.
Madam Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill number 280 with /E be moved to the next committee of referral with the individual recommendations.
And the
attached, pardon me?
Attached fiscal note, there's one in there. Or is there an objection? Hearing no objection, this bill will move on to Labor and Commerce. Be referred to Labor and Commerce. Thank you. We'll go back now to the previous bill that we were hearing on the PFD. Senator Elton, we were waiting on you. The sponsor of the bill has given his explanation as to why he does not support the amendment. We're going to allow you to speak to your amendment at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the courtesy both the sponsor of the bill and you have extended to let me escape for a few moments, and I appreciated the suggestion by Senator Dyson that people might want to know what we would be talking about after, you know, at least before they provided public testimony. Madam Chair, I move amendment, we'll call it amendment number 1 because I believe it's the only one in front of us.
Mm-hmm. I object.
Okay, Madam Chair, the amendment is a 2-page amendment, but the essence of it is fairly simple. It changes the title of the bill to allow an allowable absence people who are participating in AmeriCorps programs, and then the substance of the change in the bill is on page 3, line 2. Following 17, inserting serving as a volunteer under the National Community Service Trust Act of 1993, AmeriCorps. And Madam Chair, speaking to the bill as a little bit of background, perhaps, I think I'm responsible in a previous life, perhaps when I was in the House, for one of the exceptions, and that was the exception for PFDs that allows Alaskans to attend for a terminally ill person. That's a member of the immediate family, and that requires them to leave the state. And I recognize, I think, not having heard perhaps the argument of the sponsor, I recognize, of course, that one of the things that we need to be very careful about as we make changes that allow different absences, that we not provide a Christmas tree kind of an atmosphere, where one good idea is met by a second good idea is met by a third good idea. And I would just suggest that this being the last committee of referral, I think the only Christmas tree that occurs is if we allow 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 amendments. This is a simple amendment that provides to members of the AmeriCorps the same consideration that we allow to members of the Peace Corps. That's probably the closest analogy. I would just note that that without this amendment, you could have a Peace Corps volunteer who works on one side of the Rio Grande River in Mexico, waving at an AmeriCorps volunteer on the Texas side. One would be getting a PFD and the other wouldn't. It's my understanding that this bill right now would affect about 59 volunteers. I would also note that AmeriCorps volunteers, they are paid. They get a stipend. It's in the neighborhood of, I think, $800 to $1,000. It's not an awful lot of money. These people, I mean, I guess the other difference between them and a Peace Corps member is that Peace Corps members are working in foreign nations. These people are volunteer to help rebuild places in America, everything from inner city schools to working on repairing New Orleans after Katrina. So I do think that this is worthy of an exception. I this was not my idea. I think I've mentioned to the chair and perhaps to others that this idea was brought to me, and I committed to making the amendment only after I committed to the notion that this is a very good idea. And with that, I'm prepared to try and answer any questions the members of the committee might have.
And I also want to give the sponsor of the bill to give his unreadiness of this amendment so that you may hear what he has to say, and then we'll continue to discuss this.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll do this as succinctly as I can, and reiterating, this is great. I get to argue twice.
you practiced the first time?
Like I practiced, sir. And Madam Chair, through the chair, Senator Elton, you really have two resistances to including this amendment in the bill. One is a purely practical, purely pragmatic, and that I believe that it increases the likelihood that this bill would fail in this session, and that the substance of this bill, as it exists, limiting only to this very much clarifying a regulatory inconsistency, is something that is universally well received by the bodies, both the House and the Senate. Any, no matter what it might be, no matter how meritorious, any further exception clauses always create great controversy. We all witnessed how it. I believe it was a 4-year process for the Peace Corps amendment to be adopted. So with all respect, again, I'm quite frankly advocating as strongly as I can for places where we have absolute agreement in the body and not wanting to introduce an element of discord in the bodies, plural. Secondly, and then substantively, both pragmatic and then my substantive concern, we researched the history of the Peace Corps Amendment, and during the testimony on the Peace Corps Amendment, the VISTA program had been discussed. It was brought into that context as well. And we said, well, if it was brought up then, why was it not adopted in that context? It would have seemed very logical. And the answer was that the the legislative consensus was that, well, VISTA volunteers may serve, or they do serve domestically. That includes Alaska. We have VISTA volunteers from other states working in Alaska. And it was sort of, I guess the consensus was that, well, if we're going to be encouraging people to volunteer into VISTA, well, why wouldn't we want those people to actually stay and work in Alaska? Alaskans helping Alaskans. And it was seemed to be a little bit of a conflicting objective to sort of incentivize someone, an Alaskan, a young Alaskan, with a very, truly altruistic motive, to go, as you say, be working in El Paso when we have such great needs across this state, whereas in the Peace Corps is a situation that is not otherwise available in the state. It's really the international service. And I would, that rationale is very consistent with the second amendment in the exceptions that exist in the existing statute. And that's when we talk about the exception that says you're receiving vocational, professional, or other specific education on a full-time basis and then determined by the Alaska Post-Secondary Education Commission is not reasonably available in the state. So whereas the VISTA program can, it's an in-state and out-of-state thing. There are comparable programs in the state where people can continue to provide volunteer services that in order to not introduce sort of a strange tension and an odd conflict into our exceptions, the VISTA program was not adopted in the previous legislature where the Peace Corps program was rationalized. So both that's both a pragmatic from just a simply wanting to see a bill that we all agree on go forward, and then where I think there's some merit to the substance of the discussion on VISTA. I truly believe the folks that are committed and believe the VISTA is an appropriate exception would be better served bringing it forward as a separate standalone provision to prevail on its own merits.
Is there any further discussion of this amendment? I just want to state, if no one else has anything to say on it, this particular amendment has been offered at two others, at least two other committees, and it has failed. And my unreadiness about the amendment is not that I don't support the idea. I do. But this particular bill, if we stick this in here now and it has to go back to the House and we only have 2.5 weeks left, there's a possibility that it will not pass. The other concern that I have is that I did, well, it's not a concern, but knowing that there was another bill, and maybe you're not supposed to talk about what happened on the House side, but there is another individual bill. And I called that individual and asked them would they push that bill forward so that that too could come to us for our recommendation as accepting it rather than having to put it within this bill. And it was decided that they didn't want to do that. And at that time, when I found that out, it was too late to have an individual bill introduced. And I hadn't had time to talk with the committee. I just decided to let it go. And then now we have this amendment before us. I maintain my objection, and so all this. Yes.
Madam Chair, and wrap up just briefly.
Sure, you may.
Speaking, I mean, I understand the comments and the arguments made by the sponsor. I don't think I disagree on the substance. Would just like to point out a couple of things. My preference would probably be to add this and subtract three or four, because quite frankly, I mean, I think that one of the challenges that we always have is prioritization, and I don't understand, quite frankly, some of the priorities that we have in this list of exceptions. I don't understand, for example, why a person who works as a staffer to one of our congressional delegates, I don't understand why they can get a dividend, you know, without ever perhaps having stepped foot in Alaska. So to me, this is more important than that provision. I don't understand why somebody who commits to volunteerism is kept out of the dividend system, while somebody who is working as a mariner in the Merchant Marine does qualify for it, and they might not get back to Alaska for a long period of time. To the point that the sponsor made that we want to encourage Alaskans working in Alaska, and that maybe we should have a structure that promotes volunteerism in Alaska. I mean, that's a good argument. But that's not the argument that compelled this previous legislature from promoting volunteerism in foreign countries. So I think that, I'm not unsympathetic to any of the arguments that I have heard against this. I just, perhaps this amendment could have been coupled to removal of a couple of other exceptions that are already in law. I decided that was one way for sure to kill the amendment, so I didn't do that. But I do think that if you look at this on the merits, that it is these people who have dedicated themselves to service at considerable sacrifice deserve the same consideration that anybody else on the list does. And with that, I appreciate the forbearance of sponsor and the chair gave to me because I was called next door before another committee, and I want to express that appreciation again. Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's the end of my
report. All right. Did you call the roll?
We are
call a roll on adopting the amendment or not?
Yes.
Yes.
No.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike.
That completes the information for the bill. Or is there any other concern about this particular bill?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
To prove that I have no hard feelings, would you give me the honor of moving the bill?
I would love to give you that honor.
Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill 284. I think it's backslash version C with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objections to that? If not, let's move to the next committee of referral, and I guess it goes to rules.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
And thank you very kindly for your hospitality today.
You're quite welcome.
You're good at this.
We have no other business to come before us today, and we're going to adjourn at this time, 25 minutes to 3:00.